Los Angeles County in 2007, there were 845 murders, and crime reporter Jill Leovi covered them all. She published her reports in a blog called The Homicide Report. Her work on that blog and her experience working with the Watts Homicide Squad eventually resulted in the book Ghettocide, a true story of murder in America. The book is nonfiction, but it reads more like a detective story, the kind that includes riveting characters, dogged pursuit of perpetrators, and eventually justice. But there are broader themes in this book, and that's what we're going to talk about this hour on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Jill Leovi, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Hi, John. Thank you.
So how many interviews is this in the last 10 days or so?
Too many, quite honestly. Yeah. Too many. It's actually difficult, but I'm trying to rise to the occasion for you.
Okay, well, I'll try to ask all the questions everyone else has already asked you, so you won't have to think up any new answers. So I'll start with something really, really obvious. What was it that led you into crime reporting, and more specifically, reporting on homicide in South Central L.A.?
Well, that's actually a hard question, because from my perspective, and maybe it's the perspective of years gone by now, it's the most important story there is. I can't imagine doing anything else. It's the most compelling reporting I've ever done. I think it's momentous, and I think it's extremely perplexing. And so I guess very early on, I decided it was perplexing and that I was puzzled and baffled by it, and that's probably drawn me along through these years.
You had questions and you wanted to get answers, and you went where you thought you could get them.
I did want an answer, yes.
One of the questions is, black-on-black crime goes largely unreported. Why is that?
I mean, it does and it doesn't. One of the things I say in the book is that it's something that everybody kind of knows intuitively. In America, I think it's one of the things that we accept about modern life is that there's an urban murder problem, and lots of people have talked about that and taken different angles of it over the years. In terms of covering individual murders in a place like Los Angeles County, there's simply too many for a single media outlet to chronicle them all, unless it's in a very specialized format like the Homicide Report blog that you referenced. There's too many, and actually, even when you do get into covering those murders, there's a great difficulties and complications in covering them that are different from covering other kinds of crime. But obviously, one of the marching orders for if you're a journalist and you work in a news organization is to cover news, is to cover things that are new to people and unusual. And fortunately, the basic circumstances of a lot of these killings are not that unusual.
Well, one of the features of a lot of these crimes, not only do they go unreported specifically by news outlets, but they're often unsolved and unprosecuted. Isn't that true?
Yes. I think the measurements are fairly crude. It's hard to get a hold of an idea, especially that final step in the process, how many people are actually convicted of murders after their cases go through the court system. But I think it's fair to say that there's a good 40% of homicides in urban areas, large urban areas, that go unsolved. And certainly if you go back into the higher crime years of the 1990s and the early 2000s, we saw half or less of those homicides solved in urban areas, and with the hardest to solve black-on-black gang murders in very high crime divisions of LAPD and in the unincorporated county, maybe less than that, maybe 40% are solved.
Well, and when one of the statistics that law enforcement agency uses is their clearance rate, but that basically just means that somebody was arrested for a crime, charged with a crime. That's not this person was convicted and sent to jail, a la
Dragnet.
Right,
and it's extremely complicated. Federal reported clearance rates include a measure called cleared by exceptional means, which actually means that no one was arrested. Sometimes it can mean various things. Sometimes it means that the suspect died before the police could catch up with him or her. Those are not a large percentage of that clearance count. I think anywhere from, 5 to 8% of homicides in urban areas. But that does shave off some. And it also, it's very hard to look to, what you want to do is follow each case individually all through the court and then put a lot of them together in aggregate to get a picture. It's very hard to do that. What I've looked at specifically for adult black men, who I kind of consider the eye of the storm statistically, because their risks are so high, that those tend to be even a little bit less likely to be solved than homicides generally. So you take 50 or 60% clearance rate on paper, you start shaving off the numbers to qualify them this way, and it gets low. And then maybe conviction rates, I think, are generally high now. They used to be lower. But you still lose maybe another 10%, 5-10% in the courts as they go through to not guilty or to cases dismissed.
Well, of course, our popular culture features now all sorts of television programs based on police procedural kinds of things. And in 40 minutes, we see the crime happen, and then we see the detectives go to work. And 40 minutes later, they've sweated a confession out of the guilty party, and we go to commercial and roll the credits. Of course, we know that's not the way it happens in real life. There are a lot of obstacles to solving crimes. It's not all just about science and the art of deduction, is it?
Well, with these street homicides, typically with these very high propensity victims, I would argue that there isn't a lot of science involved even today. That it isn't, sometimes even the autopsies are quite redundant. The detectives already know that a gun was fired and a bullet hit the victim, and that's how the person died. The cases are largely built on eyewitness evidence or other kinds of witness evidence. And the detectives that I covered in South LA would sometimes talk about the television shows that they watched, that you just talked about, the police shows. And what amazed them the most was the idea of going from one witness who says this to another witness who says this, to the next witness, which is often how those TV shows are structured, or at least in their view. And they fixated on that because, of course, from the very first witness, nobody is talking to them. They don't actually have a narrative from one witness to another that they're building on.
Well, and even if, let's say three or four people witness the same exact incident, each one of them is going to have a different story. Assuming they're willing to talk to you in the first place, but
successfully prosecuted murder cases tend to have a lot of different overlapping threads of evidence. They're built on corroboration, and sometimes those cases will have some inconsistencies in them. That's quite a normal thing, but the preponderance of evidence that does corroborate carries the case. I think that's an important thing for the public to understand, that it's fairly normal, even in effective, successfully prosecuted cases where an impaneled jury has vetted the case, to find that there's enough evidence to prove reasonable doubt, even if there are some eyewitness inconsistencies.
You alluded to this a moment ago about the idea that it is oftentimes difficult to get people to come forward who know things and to talk to the police. Talk about some of the challenges, particularly in neighborhoods like South Central Los Angeles, that the police face when they're investigating a murder.
So this is one of the main issues I talk about in Get Aside, mainly because it's just ever present. In whenever the detectives are dealing with cases, almost uniformly, if the environment, if the neighborhood is high crime, and if there is a lot of unsolved crime, people are very scared to talk to the police and slam doors in their faces. And in one incident I talk about the book, leave a note on the door saying we're not home, but when they actually are home because they know the detectives are coming. There is a lot of, I think, unseen intimidation that goes on in the streets. There's people are afraid of reprisals, and they talk about that quite openly. When I go around afterwards and talk to them, I gave the example in my book of a witness who I knew had seen the crime and hadn't been particularly cooperative, and I went and talked to him afterwards, and he said that that he'd been threatened several nights in a row by mysterious people who came and parked in front of the house and roared their engine and threw rocks at the windows, and that he was afraid to talk. So that's something that's a typical thing that might happen.
So fear of reprisal is certainly one reason why people wouldn't cooperate with law enforcement. There are some pretty significant trust issues as well. Can you maybe give us an idea of where those come from and how they manifest themselves?
Right. Trust and legitimacy are really the heart of Get Outside, and the story, the detective story that you talk about is kind of a vehicle for discussing that issue of how the criminal justice system builds trust and legitimacy in these high crime communities where that's so essential to the long-term sort of suppression of crime, although we often don't think of it that way. There's a lot of examples of this in my book, but one of them is a woman whose son has been injured terribly in a shooting. This is sort of another hidden tale of the homicides that we do hear about, is that for every homicide, there's probably four or five serious penetrating injury assaults involving gunshots or knives, and that often hurt people quite badly, and those are even less likely to be solved. Those are very difficult cases. In this case, her son was injured, hospitalized for a very long time, but recovered, but the case was never solved. So when somebody else is murdered on the street and the police come to her and say, we want to interview your son because we think he's a witness, she does not cooperate. And one of the things she says is, well, they didn't solve my son's case, so I've really come to think that they're not serious. She had become deeply cynical about the system.
Mm. We're talking with Jill Leovi, the author of the book Ghettocide, A True Story of Murder in America. And there's a lot in here that can be applied not just to Los Angeles, but to the rest of the country as well. We're going to try and broaden our discussion out, but there are still some points about the book specifically I want to raise. We're going to take a short break. I'm just want to give our audience a chance to join us as well. If you have comments or questions, 800-486-8655 is the toll-free number to call to join the discussion here on the Kathleen Dunn Show. 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can find the Kathleen Dunn Show on social media. Make your comment or leave a question on Facebook. You can also find us on Twitter. So lots of ways to get in touch. We hope you will. Makes for a more interesting discussion that way. So give us a call, 800-486-8655. We'll be back with more with Jill Leovi about Ghettocide in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour on the Kathleen Dunn Show, we're talking about the book Ghettocide, A True Story of Murder in America, by Jill Leovi. Jill is an award-winning journalist who started a groundbreaking blog called The Homicide Report for the Los Angeles Times. And it covered all 845 murders in a single year. Jill Leovi, black-on-black crime isn't a new concept. It certainly isn't restricted to South Central L.A. Let's put this in a little bit of a historical context. You talk about this in your book, and you recount some of the history in the United States, just looking at the U.S. This goes back a long ways. We really haven't paid much attention to black-on-black crime. It's been kind of a racial thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's race is important here simply because it's, I think it's important to put our focus on who dies most often. Adults, black men are our number one crime victims. They're the people who we know most need to make safe and to protect in this country. And that's just based on the numbers. That's based on what we see on paper and crime statistics. In my book, there's a lot of variation over time, and there's a lot of difficulty in counting homicides, I think, especially if you get back into decades and decades ago. But I do think Americans have a general impression that this started in very modern times, started maybe with crack cocaine or in the 80s when we started to hear a lot about gangs and street violence. But it does predate that. Disproportionate black homicide rates were evident in L.A., which got a very relatively late migration from the South. As early as the 1940s, people recorded high black homicide rates going back into the South, really to Reconstruction. There are signs that this was a problem, I think, that came out of the South with two successive migrations in the 20th century of black laborers from the South. So that's an enormously interesting thing because, especially with my interest in legal structures, if you view this problem through that prism and you say, well, what about black Americans going back into history, some very obvious threads suddenly stand out. Of course, that history of the South is so much a history about legal infirmity and about kind of a twisted situation, particularly with criminal law and race, going back into Jim Crow. And so some of my book, and I talk about that. I talk about the idea of unsolved murders, the idea of impunity, of a violent crime happening outside the law, without the killers being brought to account, and how that theme kind of echoes through Southern history, and I think for different reasons cropped up in the industrial cities of the North and West after the migrations.
Well, do we know why this is? Do we have any inkling about why? For example, I mean, you point out the statistic in your book: black males make up just 6% of the total population of the United States, but they're 40%, nearly 40% of the homicide victims. Do we have any research that tells us why that is?
Well, what I assert in the book is that this is a problem of legal development, and it's actually quite a typical problem. And you see it worldwide, and you see it throughout history, and it is reminiscent in some ways of problems we see in other countries where there is, in the aftermath of a civil war, where state authority is disputed or the legitimacy of the state is in question. We see it in some tribal settings where there's a state government and a tribal government, maybe some problems with legitimacy there. You see it in South America and Latin America with urban dwellers who are dealing with the legitimacy of the police. Just about anywhere where there is a enclave of people, a minority enclave, and they are somehow at odds with state authority, you tend to see high homicide rates, high levels of infighting in those groups, I think. That's a very general statement. But what I try to lay out and get us at is the idea that high homicide is actually very human. It's something that we see in all kinds of human societies that lack adequate legal structures that afford the state a monopoly on legitimate violence. And I think if you look at the totality of American history and think about the role of race in that history, that there's abundant reason why that problem would have developed around black Americans in our history. There's many of those same threats, the idea of a group of people who are living at odds with the state, with state authority in the South, and those tensions still existing even later on. I say in my book that in a lot of ways that we don't talk about, the system by the end of the 20th century is very professional, is, you know, working in a legitimate way. There's many people in law enforcement and who work in the criminal justice system who are not corrupt, who are committed to their jobs, and there's many colorblind outcomes that you can point to. But because all of these problems of legitimacy had been passed down the line for so many decades, if simply a lack of resources alone is enough to produce the same conditions on the ground. In the South, you know, you had Southern police officers during Jim Crow actively working to keep the black man down, to use the parlance that you see in the literature, or simply turning their backs to infighting among blacks in the South. And then you see in the late 20th century, you know, very high rates of violence, gang violence in the city, and, completely overwhelmed law enforcement and courts. There was a study that some LA Times reporters did in the early 90s, which, of course, is the height of American homicide, and they found that the courts were so overwhelmed that people were being charged with for murdering people who were actually still alive because everything was so slapdash. And I think, many people who remember those years might relate to that, that the net result of that was a kind of weakness of criminal justice in terms of solving cases, effectively prosecuting the people who should be held accountable for murder.
Well, and then you also have really starting in the late 60s and in increasing into the early 70s, and particularly during the Reagan years, this whole idea of law and order, and people should just not break the law. And if they do break the law, we want to throw them in prison for a long time. Because, by golly, that'll show them. And so we have the highest incarceration rate in the world. Perception is reality. Perception is reality. And so if you perceive that the system is unfair, even if it really isn't, it's still unfair.
Well, and this is a very complicated story. I say in my book that actually it's both. The system is both oppressive and inadequate at the same time. And the prison story you mentioned is an interesting one. Prison terms are a lot longer. I have to speak, I'm afraid, through a California viewpoint. Of course, this varies from state to state. But that is a huge factor in the growth of our prison population, that the prison population gets bigger with longer sentences in the same way that the worldwide human population is getting bigger because we're all living longer, right? That's absolutely true. There's been lots and lots of research about that. But think about the difference between solving a case and sentencing an offender to a long prison sentence. The prison sentence can be very long, but if lots and lots of people are still getting away with murder, it doesn't necessarily change conditions on the streets very much. There is some research that indicates that it's actually not the harshness of the penalty, it's the swiftness and certainty of being caught that is the real deterrent. So if you were to hone in on that issue of the swiftness and certainty of being caught, I don't think that you see a whole lot of change in that era of so many changes going, as you say, from relative leniency to this very harsh law and order model.
And statistically speaking, America seems to be a much more violent place than other developed countries, countries in Europe, countries in Scandinavia, Japan. Again, statistically speaking, are we actually a more violent place generally, or is the kind of thing that happens, say, in areas like South Central LA, and there are other areas in the country, does that skew the numbers a little bit?
It definitely skews the numbers, but I think both things are true compared to the wealthier European nations. Yeah, we're a rough bunch in America. We have a little bit of a rough justice side to our state institutions and our culture. Even if you think even about the mythology of being American, has a lot to do with what legal scholars might call legal self-help, the idea of settling scores on your own. And I think that there's reasons for that actually go back to the Revolutionary War. Eric Monkanen, who's a historian I quote a lot in my book, talks about studying 19th century courts in the U.S. and in New York in particular, and how some kind of tolerance for personal violence was built into the system, and that lots of, in those days, you know, maybe less than a third of the people who went on trial for murder were ever convicted. We let a lot of people go. And so I do think that that's part of our history. He also talks about how kind of distrust of police and a deep skepticism about police authority is part of the national character. He gives examples of how in 19th century court juries were not only eager to acquit people, but that they would take up a collection for the defendant after they'd acquitted them because they had sympathy for the defendant in cases. So, yes, to some degree, and white Americans, too, I think, have somewhat higher murder rates than Europeans do. And Latinos are somewhere between whites and blacks in terms of their murder rates. But it's the black murder rate that really drives things up in terms of making all our numbers high. And more importantly, it's thousands of lives that we're losing, and all sorts of other corrosive indirect effects that I think having these homicides in our society constantly.
Well, and that's really a key point. I mean, these are human beings who are being killed every day. We've somehow or other been able, we talk a lot about statistics, and as long as we can reduce people to numbers, it doesn't really matter as much. But these are actual living, breathing human beings who are dying. And how do we change the public perception of that so that people actually get it, that these human lives matter just as much as their own?
You know, I think people do care about this. I think we have not had a framework for talking about it in a way that moves us forward. What you say is, of course, true. It's true and then some if you are doing what I've done over the last several years, which is just going door to door and talking to people. You cannot believe how much pain is out there over lost children and lost siblings and lost spouses. And it's everyone. I have yet to cover. I've covered, you know, scores and scores of homicides. I have yet to find the victim who wasn't loved by somebody. I would add something else here, which is that you'd be surprised. People sometimes suggest to me that that victims who are drug dealers, that victims who are gang members, or victims who are criminally involved somehow leave less of an emotional crater when they're murdered. And I would say, you know, that situation of parents who've had an adolescent, and I think a lot of parents can relate to this, who grow up and grow away from their influence and go through a bad phase and are hanging around with the wrong people, and maybe there's tension in the household and they're trying to get them to straighten out, and there's been arguments, and maybe there's some antagonism in that relationship, and in the middle of that, the young man is murdered, and they never can resolve that, and their last, you know, few months or few years with them was in a situation of arguing and antagonism. That is an extraordinarily painful situation, and in some ways it adds another complexity even beyond the loss of a son. So it's exactly the opposite of what people think.
Well, you in your book, you talk about, you describe the way homicide detectives look at some of these things. And the idea, you know, that person's killed, whatever they were when they were alive, they're dead, but that's somebody's son. That's somebody's daughter. There's a parent there. Somebody is grieving for that person. That really struck me when I read that, because I guess I knew that, but, you know, the way that was put, I thought that was really telling.
Yeah, it's older victims too. I think that's really important to point out that child victims or very young people tend to get more media coverage, and I think it's maybe more easily comprehensible why that's atrocious when you see a very young person killed. But again, when you're actually out talking to people, sometimes those 30-year-old, 40-year-old, 50-year-old victims, those are people who their loved ones have had them for their whole lives. They may have children. They may have grandchildren. There's many, many connections they have from being in the world so long, and those losses are terribly mourned also.
We have a comment from Sherry on Facebook, and she sends us this. There has been a lot of attention paid lately to the high rate of incarceration for black men. How do the disparities in incarceration compare to disparities in being the victim of a crime between black and white as well as other races? I would like to hear your guests' view on how this affects the issue of how much and what kind of police presence is most effective in communities such as Los Angeles in the ghetto where you worked.
I'm not going to be able to do the math in my head here, but she's getting to an important point, which is that there are higher incidents of violent crime in these enclaves of people. Violent crime is very concentrated, and because we deploy police, we deploy the number of police officers generally, certainly in Los Angeles, by formula according to the rate of crime in an area. Inevitably, these areas also get more police officers per capita and per geographic, per spatial area. Many more police officers in some cases. I think you could still argue that there's some under-policing going on because the comparison is so difficult. You have some suburban areas with no violent crime at all, and then you have rates of 20 per 100,000, 30 per 100,000 in some of these urban areas. So it's hard for police departments to deploy across that difference. But as a practical matter, when I walk around on the streets or stand with a group of young men on a street corner to talk in Watts, sometimes a police car will pass every minute and a half. And I know that there are other neighborhoods in the city of Los Angeles where people will go months without ever seeing a police officer. So some of these numbers that we see on paper, everything is intensified in this world. All the possible conflicts between police and the population are intensified. There's just much more activity going on. There's, I think, a different kind of policing going on sometimes. There's, if you look at the numbers of guns seized on the street from one neighborhood to another in L.A., there's vast differences in those. So think of what that's like as a police officer to be in a world where guns are always in question when you stop somebody versus a place where it's very rarely so. The crime victimization numbers are out of whack just as you see these sort of imprisonment numbers being out of whack. I don't know. Do they match up exactly? People can debate that a lot, but people are indubitably suffering higher incidents of violent crime in these places.
Sherry, thanks so much for that comment on Facebook. You could make a comment on Facebook. We'd read it on the air, ask our guest a question, or better yet, Why don't you give us a call, 800-486-8655. We're talking with Jill Leovi, author of the book Ghetto Side, A True Story of Murder in America. And I want to get to that story because the heart of the book is the story that you tell about a specific case and how it was investigated. And we're going to take a little break here, Jill Leovi. And when we come back, I would like you to introduce us to some of the main characters in your book and tell us a little bit about them. Obviously, I don't want to give away the whole story because, we want people to buy the book, right? But and then the other thing is another main thing I want to make sure we get to before we run out of time is I'd like to hear you weigh in about how police strategies come into play here. For example, broken windows policing, stop and frisk, that kind of thing, and how effective you think those are. We'll a lot to get to. And not a whole lot of time left. Gosh, this hour is just flying by. So I'll stop talking right now. We'll get to a break. We'll come back. We'll have more of our conversation. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about the book Ghetto Side, A True Story of Murder in America, written by Jill Leovi, who is an award-winning reporter with the Los Angeles Times. She's covered crime in South Central L.A. She developed a blog called The Homicide Report, covered all 845 murders in 1 year, and generally was embedded with the police in that part of Los Angeles. Learned a lot. She wrote a book about it, and she's telling us about it this afternoon on The Kathleen Dunn Show. 800-486-8655, the number to call. Let's talk about the story that you tell, because I don't want us to finish the program and not talk about this. Introduce us to some of the main characters, starting with John Skaggs, Bryant Tonelli, and Wallace Tonelli. Those are the kind of the three main people that weave in and out of this thing.
Yes. So Wally Tonelli is a black homicide detective who's worked for many years for the LAPD, highly respected. Homicide detective who's risen through the ranks. He lives in South Los Angeles, and the book tells the story of several murders, but one of the main ones is the street murder of his son, who was a Catholic high school graduate and not involved with gangs, and was killed walking on the street near their home. The case has the usual difficulties and impediments of what I term in the book these ghetto-side murders, these black-on-black street murders, and it goes unsolved for a period of time until the detective lieutenant pulls Detective named John Skaggs, who's cut his teeth in the Watts division of the LAPD, in and Detective Skaggs, kind of unique individual. He's a bit bullheaded, I would say. He's very effective at solving these cases. He drinks a lot of coffee. He doesn't take lunch breaks. He is extremely neat and organized, which is one of the credos of his unit. And he has practiced and practiced and practiced the skills needed for exactly these kinds of cases. And so he comes in and applies it to this case, and the story of the book follows what ensues after that.
And did the fact that the one of the victims you talk about, Bryant Tonelli, was the son of a highly respected LAPD homicide detective make this case more important to the department than it would have been otherwise?
It was an emotional case for the department. It happens that Detective Tonelli is, I think it's fair to say personally, quite an oppressive man. He's extremely hardworking, extremely humbled, and extremely well-liked in the ranks of the LAPD. This was, I think, a very painful thing for his colleagues, for his son to have been murdered, and for the case to have gone unsolved for any period of time. But one of the points I made in the book, and one of the reasons I wrote it as I did, is that there's a case immediately preceding John Skaggs' involvement in this case, and another very sort of invisible murder case, a 16-year-old young black man, a similar story, no involvement with gangs, but caught on the street in a gang shooting. And, I would say Detective Skaggs brings the same energy instead of skill to all these cases. Part of the point of the book is that he had become an artisan of these cases, that he had been applying the same tactics and the same exertion to these cases for a long time, sort of out of sight and not getting much notice, but that's why he was able to proceed with this case once he had it.
You know, when I read your descriptions of Detective John Skaggs, I thought, gosh, this, except for the fact that he doesn't have any debilitating personal flaws, he could be a character in a James Ellroy novel.
Well, I really try not to dramatize, actually. Yes, the detective story is a well-trod subject, but part of the reason I wrote Get Aside the way I did is I think the details matter. I think it's important to tell the truth and be very, very concrete, and I really try not to dramatize him. And what you said is an important point. That's the idea of a troubled homicide detective who's kind of a loner and is I think mythology. What I see in the LAPD is that the successful people tend to be healthy and happy and have well-rounded lives simply because of the energy it takes to do the job. You cannot really be an effective professional if you're constantly distracted by a lot of personal problems. I would say that people who succeed in that job tend to be very, very resilient people with kind of solid personal lives behind them, and John Skaggs is certainly that person. He's somebody who loves sports. He's got a very happy family, I would say, and that was part of the equipment he brought to this job.
Mm-hmm. We've got some callers who want to join us. Let's hear from John in Milwaukee first. John, thanks for joining us today. Go ahead.
I was wondering what she thinks of the role of the drug trade in creating gangs and gang violence, considering that we import so much heroin from
the role of drugs in the situation, for example, in South Central. What's the role of drugs there?
A little bit recondite, I guess. It's super interesting to me. One thing that Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, I think, did a study not too long ago that kind of confirmed what I've often talked to homicide detectives about, which is you'd be surprised how few of the disputes involved in these homicides have to do with straight drug deals, with debt and things like that. A lot of them are other kinds of disputes or sort of long-lasting feuds or retaliation for previous murders. One of the detectives in the book was previously a narcotics officer, and I remember him standing in front of the whiteboard where they listed all the cases one day and saying, I always thought, even I as a police officer, I always thought these were drug homicides, and so far this year we haven't had a single one. Mm. So that's a very important thing. It's all sorts of disputes, all manner. I would really say it's just a whole grab bag of conflicts that drive the homicides. But at the same time, I do think that black markets are an engine for homicide. It just stands to reason. If people are living in an underground, they are cut off from state authority. Young men on the street will sometimes tell me that we would go to the civil courts if we were white-collar businessmen, but because we're selling drugs, we have to fight it out. We don't have a way to adjudicate our disputes. They would talk about that very plainly, so I think that's important. You saw in L.A., certainly, I think it's interesting, in the crack cocaine area in the big years in the early 90s, part of what was happening is a lot of money flowing in from the outside, people who didn't live in these neighborhoods, buying their drugs from these neighborhoods. And I think that can be like fuel on a fire. If there's a lot of assets to fight over, and there's a lot of stakes in controlling that street asset, it can really up the level of fighting. And certainly we saw that in our cities in the 90s.
We have another caller on the line. Marilyn is with us from Milwaukee today. Marilyn, hello. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. I want to tell you about a case here in Milwaukee in which the young man witnessed a crime, a minority, and he was threatened and told not to go to court and testify. He courageously testified, and he was killed. And they've made an annual award in his name. Pauly is his last name. And it shows that the community can step forward, but it also shows why they might not want to.
Marilyn, thank you for your call. That's certainly what Marilyn is talking about. That you talk about that as well. People are afraid because sometimes you testify, you get killed or threatened at any rate.
Yes, I think that's a heartbreaking story that she just told. I know people who whose lives are not touched by crime very much at all, who are reluctant to even serve their jury duty when they get that summons. And I think it's important to remember that there are other people, often people without a lot of money or resources or political power, who are being asked to stand up in court and show a kind of courage that that rarely are people asked to show in life. The takeaway is that the system is actually really important, and that we all should bear a piece of it on our shoulders, I think.
There's been a lot of talk over the last few years about how to solve some of these persistent problems of violence and murder. Different police strategies have been employed. We've heard a lot about broken windows policing, prevention, stop and frisk, that kind of thing. What's your take on all of this? And based on your experience and the police officers that you've talked to and the various people in these neighborhoods you've talked to, what's it going to take to make a difference, and are we seeing it happen?
Well, my own take is it's going to take some really deep thinking. I think we haven't thought about this deeply enough. I think we haven't been mystified enough, if that makes any sense. It shouldn't stand to reason just because a neighborhood is poor that it would have a high crime rate. And there's actually research that shows that poverty is not necessarily the most important operative factor here. So I think if we had a better idea of the reasons for it, we wouldn't feel like we're shooting in the dark quite so much. And that's why I really am interested in getting to first causes and to comparing our homicide problems to homicides in a wider context and to other contexts. I think that kind of work is important. You know, the other thing I'd say is I'm not a big fan of broken windows, as anyone who's read the book might draw, though there's obviously a balance between different strategies. But all of that stuff, the people who, the architects of these ideas are not people who, are seeking to do harm. This is all good intentions. Many, many of these efforts, including, things that are generated by police departments, are well-intentioned efforts to reduce violence. I think that the material effects on the ground can still conspire to produce high homicide rates, even when the system is well-intentioned, which is important, because there's a tendency to say, well, it's just bad police officers, or it's just general racism that causes this. It's so much more complicated than that. It's not easy.
Reading your book, it just seems to me like we've oversimplified this problem for years, and we've imagined that there is a solution, some magic potion out there that we're going to spread around on the ground and make this thing go away. And the conclusion that I drew from your book is that's silly. It's not that way at all, and we do need to think more about it and perhaps do some harder looking. But the first thing we need to do is care about it, because it seems like we think we do, but if we did, wouldn't we be doing more?
Yeah, well, I agree completely. I wrote the book because I want people to care about it. I mean, the only caveat I would say to what you just said is that I also think that a sense that it's too much of a tangle of pathology is a famous phrase, or it's just too big and implicates kind of every social aspect of these neighborhoods has also made it hard to deal with. And one of the ideas I'm trying to get across in Ghetto Side, that there are actually some simple material things that are involved in this, like solving more homicide cases, that could give us some traction. There are things that can be done. It's not this baffling, eternal problem.
Well, we are out of time for this session. I really appreciate your being here, and good luck with the rest of your book tour.
All right. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Jill Liovi, author of Ghetto Side. This program was produced by KP Whaley. On-air production today from Lisa Nalbandian and Scott Myers. Thanks to them. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.